Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
For years, I've wanted to sit at his table and talk to Nick Allett, one of our most favorite regulars at the River Cafe, who when he walks in absolutely lights up the restaurant with his deep voice and his deep warmth. I imagine we would talk about the musicals he's produced, Les Mis, Cats, Carousel, Hamilton, what he's doing now, his political battle to save theaters during the pandemic, and the great love he had for his best friend, the late brilliant restaurant critic Adrian Gill. And of course, about the food he's going to order. But then I remember the line in the classic movie Casablanca when Ingrid Bergman asked the manager of the Café Américain for Rick, her long-ago lover, Humphrey Bogart, to join her. "Madam," he responds, "Rick never sits with the customers. Never. It's the same with me. So I say hello and then leave to have whoever it is be with the person they're dining with." But today, Nick Allett is not a guest in the River Café, but a guest on Ruthie's Table 4, and we are here to talk. He's just come from the kitchen where he baked a lemon tart with the pastry chefs. He'll tell us how he made it, and then we will discuss the food he grew up with, what he cooks at home, theater and food, food and friendship. I think even Rick would approve and appreciate how lucky I am to have Nick with me, a man I adore, and for a while, all mine.
Ruthie, what a joy to be here. Thank you. So I've just come from making the River Cafe lemon tart. So, this is how you do it. You take one quantity of sweet pastry, baked. Then, for the filling, you take the finely grated zest and juice of 7 lemons, and that is quite a chore in itself. If you've got a sous chef in your kitchen who can do that work for you, that makes life much, much better. And indeed, I once had Adrian Anthony Gill as my sous chef, grating the lemons for me. Not very well, I hasten to add. 350 grams of caster sugar, 6 whole eggs, 9 egg yolks, 300 grams of unsalted butter, which is softened. You preheat the grill to high, and then you make your filling. Put all of the ingredients, except the eggs, in a large saucepan over a very low heat, stirring until dissolved. Combine the mixture with the eggs, return to the saucepan, and cook on a low heat until thick. That getting it together to, so it doesn't curdle is a real skill. You have to do it very, very slowly.
My name's Bella Tubbs. I'm the head pastry chef at the River Cafe. So we're nearly there.
Look at that.
So if I had a spoon, it would definitely be coating the back of the spoon by now. You can kind of see it round the edge starting to thicken.
And again, when it says that and you draw a line through it, should it hold completely, or does it matter if you get a few sort of...
Well, with this in particular, because we're about to put it under the grill, if you think about it, the grill's going to add a whole another layer of heat. Mm-hmm. So you don't... What you really want to do with the lemon curd before it goes into the tart filling is actually do it slightly under.
Yeah.
Have it be quite a thin curd.
Right, okay.
So that, again, we're very particular about the spots that we get under the grill. Sure. You can really tell when something's been overcooked. Mm-hmm. The spots are absolutely tiny. As with something that's been perfectly cooked, it looks much more like a sort of giraffe print.
Yeah.
And you want that kind of beautiful mottling over the whole
exactly.
thing. We grate the pastry into the tart shell, and then we press it around the edges, and then we go round with a knife. And then our trick is we freeze the tart shells and we have a whole stack once it's been made.
Yeah.
And then we can throw it in the oven without baking beans, and it doesn't, the sides don't shrink.
Right.
So very much like pizza, we're just going to slowly rotate it. Doesn't matter if there's a slight wobble to it at this point.
Because it will
eventually settle.
Yeah. What ideally is the temperature you serve that at?
Room temperature. Yeah. If you put it in the fridge, the pastry goes soggy.
Yeah.
You want it to be lovely and crisp.
How beautiful. Well,
and
there
you
go.
If you choose to eat it for lunch, it might be that exact one.
Really? I hope so. Can you put a little N on the side of it?
Yeah.
Or just on one slice? I'll make sure it is. Well, yeah, no, it's definitely one of my favourite puddings here, so.
But it's interesting that you chose a dessert. Do you like cooking?
I love cooking. I came to cooking quite late.
Yeah, tell me.
Well, growing up, food was never a big part of my life. I come from an army background. My mother was a very competent cook, but when living on army bases all over the world, in Germany, in Hong Kong, and Australia, we didn't live in England until I was in my mid-teens. And really, the ingredients that she had available to her were those available from the NAFI, you know, the army store.
She wouldn't go into the local German village and buy.
You were discouraged, basically, from leaving the base. This was sort of late 50s, early 60s, so post-war. There wasn't that much integration still in the NATO bases, more so when we moved to Australia. But again, we had a year or two in Hong Kong when I was quite young, and it tended to be what you could get from the shop that was available.
Right.
I mean, we never left the bases. I went to school, went to army schools.
Wow.
All my friends were local. Yeah. When I told my friends I'd lived in Germany for, I think, 10 out of the first 15 years of my life, they said, "Do you speak fluent German?"
Yeah.
Not one word. You just didn't integrate. Yeah. So for her, cooking was a bit of a chore.
Had she had a career at all?
She married quite young. She married my father quite young. And actually being an army officer's wife is a career in itself.
It is a career,
yeah. Because you're responsible for so much HR and looking after the army officers' wives and organising charity drives and things like that. And it was pretty full on.
Was your father on the base then all the time?
He was. No, he was away a lot of the time. He was away on manoeuvres. He was a cavalry officer, which didn't mean he rode a horse. It meant he drove tanks and things like that. And he was away a lot for exercises.
So did who cooked in the house?
My mother cooked. It never occurred to me to actually offer to help. Mm. I wasn't that interested at that
point. How many in your family?
Myself and two sisters.
Yeah. And you are the...
I'm the eldest.
Yeah.
So our relationship with food was not one of... it was not indifference, but it wasn't a key part of my life. I mean, I used to, years and years and years later, more recently, up until she died, I used to take my mother to really lovely restaurants. And she's going, "Darling, it's really lovely, but I mean, it's an awful lot of money. We could be doing better things like going to the theatre." And I go, "Well, we can do that as well, actually."
Yeah. So would you sit down for family meals every...
We did.
After school, you'd come home and sit down to the family supper prepared
we did that.
By your mother.
And I would watch, I'd watch her, you know, prepare. You have to do a lot of entertaining as an army wife.
Oh, do you?
Mm. You have to do the other officers' wives and visiting officers and things like that. As you move up through the ranks, you then start to get staff. Mm. And by the time that my father died in 1969, he was a commanding officer at a large base in Dorset. And we had, I think, a permanent chef and two or three other staff.
Yeah.
So.
And then what did that change, the food in the house? Did you feel it was a little more?
Again, not really. It was sort of pretty simple stuff. Yeah. The army didn't necessarily engage in cordon bleu and high style cooking.
This was what, the 60s?
This was late 60s, mid to late 60s. Yeah. And my relationship with food, as I say, was one of not particular interest. Unfortunately, it changed quite radically because my father tragically died in a helicopter crash when I was 15. And my younger sister...
Was he abroad in a...
No, he was killed in a helicopter. He was a passenger being flown to a conference on the other side of England. And to this day, no one really knows what happens. There was it was raised in the house and there was an investigation. But essentially, a lot of helicopters were coming in, and the helicopter flying in front of his, when it took off, instead of going out at an angle of 45 degrees, went straight up into the air, into his helicopter coming down.
And both helicopters were, everybody
all
died?
All three, the two pilots and my father were both killed. And there was an extraordinary, there were two young soldiers watching from a canteen, and they saw saw the helicopters come down. I was reading about it recently, and they ran. They jumped through the windows of the canteen and ran. And try to pull the bodies out of the helicopters, and they both got very badly burned, and they both got decorations for doing it.
Yeah.
But sadly, it was too late. It was too late.
And you were 15, and that did you then leave military?
Well, the army are the army are a wonderful family to be part of. It's rather like the theatre, actually. It's a very close community, but they're also very, very practical.
Yeah.
And if you lose the commanding officer of a base, of a big base, then you have to replace him quite quickly. So within a couple of weeks of his death, we were dispatched, as it were, and picked up, and my mother had to find somewhere else to live.
Wow.
They didn't arrange alternative accommodation. We ended up living in a little cottage on a friend's farm nearby in Dorset.
Oh. And did you go to boarding school?
I did. I went to boarding school from quite a young age. It was traditional to send boys away at 8. But then I had a wonderful break in that we were shipped to Australia. This is obviously while he was still alive. And they gave me the choice of staying in English boarding school or going to Australia.
Mm.
Not a hard choice to make, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a wonderful time in Australia.
Did you explore? Were you allowed
to? Oh, yeah. I was at a weekly boarding place where you could either go home at weekends or stay. But if you stayed, the boys that stayed, and I chose to, would go on these incredible expeditions up into the mountains and camping in the bush and learning to surf and things like that. It was everything you would expect the Australian outdoor life for a young person to be.
I wonder if the food of Australian boarding schools was any different from British.
It was very meat-based,
was it beet?
As you can imagine.
Yeah.
But we made a lot of friends there, and one of our closest friends was a sheep farmer. So my mother insisted on rescuing a lamb that had lost its mother that they were going to kill. And she said, no, you can't do that. Let me take it home. Mm-hmm. And we lived in the middle of a little town called Queenscliff. Mm-hmm. And the farmer said, you can't take a sheep. I'm with you. But she did, and we reared it in our garden. And it behaved like a dog. Mm-hmm. My mother would take it shopping with her on the end of a lead.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear the locals go, oh, here she comes. Here's Mary. Here's Mary with her little lamb. Even though her name was Shirley. So that was a very joyful part of my life.
Were you fussy about food?
I wasn't. Later in life, after my father died, unfortunately, both my sisters contracted anorexia nervosa, which was an illness in 1969 that nobody understood or knew about.
1999 probably.
Exactly. But then, two girls, 12 and 9.
They both did.
They didn't know people that young who'd had it, and they didn't know any two people in the same family.
Mm.
So that was really the only time in my life where food became a threat.
Mm. Yeah.
Mealtimes were a challenge.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine it because I'm very greedy and I love food. But my trying to get my sisters to explain, they said, if you imagine putting a bucket of slugs in front of you, that's what it's like.
Mm.
It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's sweet or savoury. Mm. And, of course, they become incredibly cunning and they hide things and they drink lots of water. And, I mean, how my mother coped, I don't know.
That is a food trauma in your life, of your father's death, and then reacting with food.
She dealt with it. She eventually, she was told, we find somebody who could who had an idea about how to cure it. Because we tried everything from faith healers to things called the box. And eventually she found a man in Westminster who said, look, I think I know how to do this, but you cannot have them together. So one child was in one hospital and one was in another. And my mother sort of drove between the two. And her response to try and get me out of that rather toxic atmosphere was basically to send me away back to Australia, which is what I did.
By yourself?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was 17. I was old enough. I was just leaving school. I was going on a gap year, but I'd never been away on my own.
Mm.
And the lovely thing about Australia then, and this is 69, 70, 71, they were getting the sort of hippie genre 2 or 3 years after the England. So I was too young to really be a hippie in the UK, but I was perfectly aged. So I hit the hippie trail, Ruthie.
Yeah,
and
what
I lived,
did you do?
I travelled all over. I was there at the creation of this extraordinary centre in Australia, which is still there. It was a festival that was supposed to start last a week and is still there 40 years later. It's called Nimbin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the centre of Australia counterculture. It's quite near Byron Bay, which is much more famous. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. They painted the whole town in rainbow colours and the locals integrated, and an invasion of Australian hippies and, in fact, people from all over the world came. And
was it music?
There was some music. People like Donovan turned up and Dollar Brand. But it was more a kind of gathering together of faiths. And
yeah.
I joined the Radha Krishna temple for a while.
Did you?
Well, only because if you chanted for them, they'd feed you at the end of the day.
What did they feed you? Back to food, you see, being the incentive.
No, exactly. It was beautiful sort of sweet rice with coconuts and sweet vegetables, all served in a banana leaf. Then I temporarily joined the Divine Light Mission, which...
For the food?
No, not for the food, that one. Mainly for the girls, who were very, very
pretty.
Girls.
Girls in the mood, yeah.
But so I tried those different things and very sadly eventually moved on. I could have stayed there probably and remained there the rest of my life.
What year was that?
Well, that was, by now we're sort of 71.
Yeah.
But then for a year, I lived almost exclusively on brown rice and vegetables. Because I was hitchhiking all over the country and through the desert in particular, you had to eat what you could carry because there weren't shops and cafes along the way. And a hippie doctor told me that brown rice was a cure-all for everything.
Yeah. I remember the macrobiotic. Do you remember macrobiotic? There was a place in London when I came
in
71.
Right. There's something in it because I cut my foot on a coral reef. And coral, as you know, is organic and it's very, very toxic. And my foot swelled up like a balloon and it started to climb up my leg. And again, we were miles from a proper doctor.
That's very dangerous.
Yeah. And he said, look, live on brown rice for a couple of weeks, which, I mean, didn't cure me, but it seemed to stop spreading. Yeah. Anyway, I then found a doctor who gave me a large shot of penicillin.
And then went back to the regular food?
No, I didn't really eat regularly until regular food as we would know it until I came back, to England and went to university.
So you never, did you become a vegetarian? Or did
I was vegetarian not out of choice, out of necessity.
Yeah.
And it didn't really bother me. Again, I wasn't really focused on food.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I dropped out of university with a loud report. I shouldn't have gone there in the first
place. Where did you go?
I went to Exeter.
Yeah. And then left after how long?
Well, I left after, I like to say my letter to them, resigning, crossed with theirs in the post,
saying,
I think you're better off elsewhere. I think mine hopefully got there a beat before. But they had a theatre on the campus there called the Northcote Theatre. And we did a lot of very good work there. I just knocked on the door.
Did you act or did you start?
No, I never did. I acted a lot at school. I went to Charterhouse, English standard public school, and I had a very, very inspirational teacher who I remember to this day called David Summerscale, who loved the theatre, and he directed plays, and I stopped doing anything else. I stopped doing sport. I stopped playing musical instruments. I just wanted
to act.
What
age was this?
13 to 18, to 17. And when I was leaving, to this day I can picture the conversation, he said to me, look, just before you go, I'm going to ask you something. I said, yes. He said, you want to act, don't you? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, forgive me, but you're not good enough.
Oh.
Wow. Bang. Arrow to the heart.
Yeah.
But he said, look, you're quite bright. You get on with people. There are many other jobs in the theatre that you could probably do quite well. And why don't you give it a go? Yeah. And it was the best piece of advice probably I've ever had. I've got lots and lots and lots of actor friends. And of course, no matter how good you are, it's an insecure profession. And I've been very lucky in the almost 50 years I've worked in the theatre never to have had a day out of work. And worked with the most extraordinary people, had the most wonderful time. So it was good. It was good and sound advice.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How do you see the parallel of restaurants and theater?
First and foremost, I love restaurants because it's an extraordinarily convivial experience. Mm-hmm. It's about being in large groups of people. I would be hopeless on my own on a desert island. Mm. I love being in crowds. Mm. I go to Glastonbury. I love football. I love sitting in a theater more than anything, and I love being in a big crowded restaurant. There's something chilling about going into a restaurant, finding you're the only person there.
Yeah.
And it's the same in the theatre.
Yeah.
You know, if you have anything less than a full house, you feel that you haven't really succeeded. And the other, I would say, the big similarity is that by and large, with small variations, you're serving the same thing every night, and we are doing the same thing in terms of presenting a play or a musical, but the audience react in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get a night when it's absolutely buzzing and jumping.
Mm.
And then for some reason you'll get another night where you think, they're not getting this.
Yeah.
They're not. And it may be the same with a crowd of people where you've got someone who's tired or picky or didn't like this or, you know, was dragged out to a restaurant by their other half who they didn't really want to go. And you can sense the vibe, which is why, you know, the difference between what you do and what I do is you're there nearly every night and you're working in the room. I mean, you know, we are our great mutual friend, Jeremy King. You know, watching him work in his restaurants is an art. And watching you, as you say, you can't spend too long at each table, but you spend just enough time to sprinkle a little bit of fairy dust.
Yeah.
Whereas we can't actually do that. I can't walk through my audience going, come on, cheer up. This is a really good bit coming up.
Yeah.
But what you can do is you can go backstage at the interval and go, hey, guys, you know, you need some kicks and butt here. You've got to raise your game a little bit.
And you can tell, and you do that.
Well, you have to because, I mean, the very, very big difference between now and when I started in the theatre is the length of run for successful shows. Mm. I mean, I came into London. That's really when I my career properly started. I'd run small regional theatres in the 70s in Liverpool and Northampton and places. But I happened, luckily enough, to come to London in 1981 when Cats started, and that was the beginning of the extraordinary 80s decade where so much change was enacted. It was, you know, love or hate Margaret Thatcher, there was massive change that came out of that. And culturally, it was a really exciting time. You know,
it was, and for restaurants.
Yeah, exactly.
At the same time
that this
was going on, Jeremy started the Ivy, and we, you know.
My first real experience of being a regular anywhere was when Jeremy was maitre d' at Joe Allen.
He said that to me this morning, that he met you at Joe Allen. What year was that?
That was 1981.
And did you, when you say regularly, what
Well,
did that
we would
mean?
Go, well, the thing is, you know, you're working in the theatre, your social life doesn't really start until the end of the curtain.
Mm.
So at about 10:30 every night, we'd all trot down to Joe Allen's.
Yeah, I asked that of actors, I asked that of Rafe, you know, the actors are, when do they eat before the theatre, during the theatre, after the theatre? And of course, some people, Emily Blunt ate the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, she was really adorable. She would say that she'd have a hamburger before, then something in the intermission and something at the end.
Yeah.
Judi Dench. Everybody had a different way.
She said she'd
have a snack. But most of the people that I know in theater or friends of mine who are in a play say, meet me after the play and we'll go out and eat.
Exactly.
Is that right? Why is that?
I think it's really because they are then suddenly off duty. They can relax. Mm. You can't help but keep your performance in the back of your head beforehand.
Mm.
You know, what's going to happen tonight? Am I going to be all right? Looking after yourself. You know, you need to really look after yourself.
Mm.
I always remember Jonathan Pryce, who's a very good friend, when he stopped temporarily being a great classical actor and became a musical actor when he did Miss Saigon for us. And he did Desert Island Discs, and he talked to Sue Lawley, and she said, tell me, what's the difference between being a classical actor and a musical actor? And he said, rashly, being a musical actor is a doddle compared to being a classical actor. And the following week, he lost his voice. And he lost his voice for quite a long time. And he said it was the most incredible lesson to learn that as a singer, you really have to look after yourself.
Yeah.
And I watched him, because he's done a lot of shows for us and talking to people like Martin McCutcheon and things like that. And he said, look, you have to learn that your voice is, it's responsible for everything as far as the audience is concerned. And therefore, you don't talk. Mm. You wake up in the morning, you do not talk to anyone until lunchtime.
And so that goes back to eating and about food and about how you take care of your body. Is that what you're saying? When you're an actor or not?
So, the thing is, acting by and large is a very physical thing. I mean, we've talked about singers looking after their voices, dancers looking after their bodies. I mean, I noticed through the year that I was the theatre manager at the New London where Cats was on, I would be in there every night watching. And there were three artists in that one year who worked out for an hour before every single performance, an hour. One was Wayne Sleep, the other was Bonnie Langford, and the third was a very, very beautiful girl who went to America and became a big star called Finola Hughes. And they were the only three who rigorously worked out. They were the only three who did not miss a performance.
Wow.
It's a real, real responsibility.
Yeah. It is,
But going back to Joe Allen's and afterwards, and of course Jeremy then went on and you know, as we all started to do a bit better.
So you would go there every
Literally every night.
Be your day?
Until I really settled into London, because in the provinces you tend to do everything and you're responsible for everything, I would never do less than a 12 or 14 hour day in the provinces. So I started to do this in London until people said, look, this is crazy. You need to actually start coming in a bit later. So I had a nice little flat in Kensington, and I'd walk in, and my day would be talking to the theatre staff, getting to know, you know, looking at the theatre bookings. This was the early days of theatre bookings where everything was manual. You know, we didn't take credit cards. We didn't do phone bookings. It was all checks or cash. And, you know, you talk to the box office queues for these big hits. Would go, you know, snake around the block for hours. People would queue. It was an extraordinary time. We were all learning on our feet then. And then, of course, there was a lot of corruption in ticket selling, because ticket touts would buy tickets and resell them at huge prices and double sell. So you'd have the very difficult task every night of actually facing up to people and going, look, I'm terribly sorry, but your tickets are either forgeries or they've been double booked. You know, and this is for a show that they may have waited a year to see. But, I mean, that time was incredible because, you know, I was a boy from the provinces, nearly in the army, and every single person I'd ever wanted to meet in my life was coming through Cats, whether it be the entire royal family. I mean, I watched Charles and Diana dancing around my office just after they were married, you know, and watching her drop into this perfect split. He said, you know, how do these dancers do that? She'd, let me show you, darling. Literally dropped into a perfect split.
But the thing about the restaurants and the theatre, or food theatre, is that they're both, I think, extremely collaborative jobs. So if you don't chop the parsley, you can't make the sauce, and if you don't probably paint the set, you can't, you know, put on the play. If you don't remember your lines, your fellow actors, you know, have a problem. Do you think there is a collaborative
similarity? No, I think there's a very, very
similarity.
It's absolutely right. I mean, theatre is an enormously collaborative venture, and the great thing is, you know, you go and see a big musical at, say, the Theatre Royal Drury Lane when we did Miss Saigon. There are 200 people involved in getting that show on, whether it be the lady selling the ice creams, the backstage usher, the person pulling the ropes, the actors, the lighting technicians, the sound technicians, and then, you know, going all the way back to the creators of the show, whether it be the authors. And in musicals, it's even more so because you have an added layer of responsibility. You have orchestrators, you have members of the band, you have choreographers, you have assistant choreographers, you have armies of people to look after it, all of whom are working to that specific moment, which is curtain up at 7:30.
Yeah, curtain up at 7:30. That's, we have a curtain up at 7:30.
Exactly the same
thing. And if the floor isn't, you know, hoovered, and the, as I said, the chef's aprons
are
clean.
And do you get into a huddle beforehand?
Yeah, we get into the huddle and we go through, and then the same, and then nobody eats before. You know, you just don't really want to eat. If you're about to cook, you have a drink. But then, did you do work in restaurants? Would it always be kind of at the end of the meal you'd just go and relax, or would you meet with Cameron or your other colleagues and
It was very, yeah, you were sort of always on the job, as you know. Mm. I mean, theatre is full of gossip and exchanging information and stuff. And, you know, in the days before social media, happy days before social media, that's how you got your information.
Yeah.
And you walk into someone like Joe Allen's and there'd be, you know, Wayne Sleep on a table over there, and there'd be Trevor Nunn with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and there would be someone from the National Theatre.
Yeah.
And there would be, as always, Princess Margaret in the corner. And so you'd move from the table hopping that went on. It was sort of became rather a joke. And Jeremy had that wonderful pianist who'd sit there, and you know, you would suddenly notice seamlessly as you walked in down those steps into that famous cellar, and he'd see you coming, and very suddenly you realise he's playing something from Cats or Les Mis or one of those tunes that you did. So yes, I mean, restaurants were always the good button.
What about another cities when you were on Broadway? Would you go to Sardi's? I grew up thinking that the theatre district was Sardi's, wasn't it?
That's where you traditionally had your first night parties.
Did you?
So our first show that I opened over there was Cats.
Yeah.
And we had a massive first night party in, I can't even remember the hotel, but I always remember they had police horses in the foyer of the theatre, and they had trucks outside with ice full of champagne, and everyone who came out, it was the most extraordinary thing. We then did Oliver on a slightly smaller scale and went to Sardi's and had a traditional Broadway opening at Sardi's, and I took the director across the room to meet our producer, a wonderful man called James Nederlando, recently died. And I said, come on, we should go and chat to Jimmy, our producer. And as we got there, an aide of Jimmy's came over, leaned over and said, the New York Times is out. It's a load of shit.
Yeah.
And
that's
everyone got up and left.
Yeah.
Apart from the Brits.
Yeah.
We're all sitting there going, what? Yeah. What just happened? Yeah. What just happened? And indeed, the New York Times was out, and it was a terrible review.
I was just about to say, you must have known it was going to be a hit.
The audiences were hysterical.
Yeah, yeah.
But at that time, the New York Times had that
and
power.
And they could close the show.
Close the show, and they did. We battled on. We spent money on television. 4 weeks later, we were gone.
Somebody else told me that story about how if you were at a party, the after party of a play, waiting for the review, then everybody would just go. It wasn't. You just leave.
It was very, very structured.
So grim. Yeah.
Yeah, because the papers would hit the streets about 11:30 midnight. You might get a tip off if the critic was friends with the publicist. So occasionally, you know, they'd whisper in Cameron's ear, Les Mis is going to be okay.
Yeah.
Nowadays, that you don't have that kind of romantic. The first night is more about social media and TV and stuff, and the critics have all been in the week before. They don't come on the first night anymore. And I think, to be honest, that's a reflection of the fact their role is not as important as it once was.
Yeah.
You know, I fear for theatre criticism just like I fear for food criticism.
Yeah.
You know,
movies.
You see the great restaurant critics are sort of slipping away.
Yeah. Talk about the restaurant critic. When we had the dinner at the River Cafe to celebrate Adrian Gill, to launch the bursary.
It was the Sunday Times prize for an aspiring food writer.
Yeah.
And they could write about food or a restaurant they'd had.
Yeah.
And it was for someone who'd never been published before.
Yeah. In my opening little speech, I read the review that he wrote about the River Cafe, which was pretty damning. And very complimentary prose, but then he focused on the nemesis. Do you remember the dessert?
Yes.
And how difficult it was to make. It was so Adrian. And we just, you know, we loved Mr.
Man
when he came into the restaurant with Nicola. It was just, he was one of a kind, and he was your closest friend.
He was, I think, genuinely was my closest male friend. We had a pretty difficult beginning because I met him at a very, very smart party, and the girl I was with at the time, who remains a very dear friend, had misread the invitation, and I turned up in full Venetian puffed trousers, puffed sleeves, great Commedia dell'arte mask.
And it wasn't a costume party?
It was for Viennese, not Venetian.
Oh, Viennese.
So everyone else was in tails and military uniform. And I was on the same table as Adrian. I hadn't met him before. I knew who he was. He was going through that rather affected stage of wearing a monocle. And he looked at me and said, one of us has got a strange idea of geography, dear, and I don't think it's me. Anyway, I rang him the next day and said, you're a bastard for making me feel so uncomfortable. He said, let me take you out to lunch. Yeah. And we did, and we became very, very good friends. And I loved going out to eat with him.
What was it like going out with a food critic?
Quite daunting in the case of Adrian. Well, first of all, there was that thing, of course, he could never go as A.A. Gill. Uh-huh. The bookings were always in the name of Mr. Oxford or Mr. Cambridge.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you'd arrive and you say, table for Mr. Cambridge, and you see the colour drain from the maitre d's cheeks. We'd sit down, and look, he knew enormous. He was, as you know, a very good cook himself. Mm. I used to read his cookery column in Tatler, and it was hysterical. Mm. He'd go for ham and pea soup. Get some ham, get some peas, cook it, you know, that sort of thing. But he was a very good. He was a very good cook, and he had enormous respect for restaurants, restaurateurs, and for particularly for front of house staff. Mm. He was very. He admired waiters a lot, but they had to know their stuff. Mm. And why it was daunting was he would challenge you just to see how much you knew. Mm. If you were being charged a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So he'd go, so tell me about the venison. And they'd go, well, it's from a deer, sir. Go, yes, I knew that. What part of the deer?
Oh, wow.
And he'd go, the waiter would either go, well, you know, it's a haunch or flank, whatever it is. Or they'd go, I'll just go and find out. Then come back and they'd say, okay, so tell me, where's the deer from? And they go, well, Highlands, New Forest. And he was testing them. I mean...
Well, he's really testing...
He's testing
the restaurant because that's the job of the...
Exactly.
That's one of the things we do at the River Cafe. The idea is that everyone participates in the prepping of the food.
Yes.
And so if you are serving, not everything, but if you're serving a salsa verde, you know because you chop the parsley and you wash the capers and you clean the anchovies. So there's a kind of involvement and then the importance of knowing how something is cooked. So he tested the restaurant.
He tested them and then, as you know, he could be absolutely excoriating if he didn't like the food. And I've met a number of restaurateurs since who knew I knew him and said, did you know your friend, you know, bankrupted me? And because I think he was one of the very, very few critics who could still, I mean, had that power. He was rather like the New York Times in the 70s.
It's fair, I think. You know,
yeah,
fair,
I think so. If you're going to be paying a lot of money, then, you know, your standards should be exacting. But when he loved you, as he loved you, and he loved Jeremy, and he loved Andrea at Riva, you know, he had his favourites, the places he would always go back to.
Would he tell you what to order?
He would try and make sure we all had something different.
Mm-hmm.
He'd go, oh, that's a bit boring if we do that. And then if we did, he'd then eat off each of our plates.
Yeah.
And what was interesting,
he didn't take notes or anything?
No, he didn't. He'd never take notes because, as you knew, he was chronically dyslexic and he couldn't spell anything anyway. Mm. He would always, at the end of the evening, asked for a copy of the menu to take away.
Right.
And that was his aide memoir.
Mm.
But we went to incredible places. I mean, you know, at the time of the great gastronomic explosion, we had, we went to Heston Blumenthal's for the first time together, and he and Heston became very good friends. And we went to Favigan in Sweden, and we went to El Bulli.
So you traveled.
Oh, we did. And Noma pop-ups and things. I mean, it was a real, it was exciting going to the theatre internationally. Okay. Sorry, into restaurants.
There we are, about the theatre.
There you go, same thing.
Would he come with you to the theatre?
Oh, yeah. He was my regular first night date. And in fact, quite more often than not, he would either bring Flora, his wonderful daughter, and I'd bring one of my sons. And they two would sit together, and Adrian and I would sit together. No, he was exacting. He was asked... In fact, I don't know if anyone knows this, he was asked to be the Sunday Times theatre critic.
Mm.
And he said, no, I can't possibly because I've got far too many good friends in the theatre and I wouldn't have any if... Because I did read a couple of his theatre reviews and they were zingers. No, I miss him every day. He was literally someone I spoke to every day.
Every day.
And what was extraordinary about him, and you probably know this again, is it was only after he died that I realized how many people he spoke to.
Yeah.
And where did he get the time to do, you know, to do that?
He
never, ever hung
contact.
Up on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had, let's just say, I've had a lot of drama in my life over the years in terms of losing close friends and losing members of my family and various, you know, problems and things like that. And I find it very difficult to cry. But the only thing that I cry like a drain is music. And music is my kind of go-to emotional release. It's a wonderfully cathartic thing. And it can be a beautiful piece of classical music or it can be a great bit of rock and roll.
Mm.
I mean, I told Bono, who's a regular client of yours, I know, that for one reason or another, I don't know why, when my first son, Tom, was born 35 years ago, I came back at 4 o'clock in the morning from the hospital, dizzy and confused. And I poured myself a large glass of scotch and danced to his song, Bad. So after that, that became a tradition. So I've got four sons, and I danced to Bad for every one of them.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you go to Glastonbury, do you eat?
Yeah, but you don't eat well. It's very hard to eat well.
Yeah.
I mean, interestingly, there's a lovely local restaurant close to us, because I live in the West Country most of the time, in Bruton, called At the Chapel.
Yeah.
I mean, Bruton's become a sort of new culinary centre of the West with OSIP and Alfred Worth.
Yeah, yeah.
But At the Chapel was the first. And it's just changed hands, and they have a pop-up restaurant in Glastonbury now.
Yeah.
And they came close to getting the sort of the At the Chapel experience, but when you're catering for many hundreds of people. So, no, it's not really about the food.
What about cooking at home?
Cooking at home I love doing, yes.
And yeah, because you described to me about cooking for your family and cooking a lot of Asian food.
Well, both are very, very important partners in my life. None of them could cook, so I sort of cooked to survive.
Mm.
And I taught myself. And then, rather wonderfully, all four of my children have loved cooking. And in fact, my eldest son, Tom, has just opened his first restaurant.
Where?
Yeah,
it's called Where is it?
Outcrop Social.
Okay.
It's a pop-up restaurant in 180 The Strand.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
And it's Thai food, and they're giving him 3 months to see if it goes. And I can say, totally objectively, he's had the most incredible reviews, and it's delicious. So good.
Let's go. What's it called then?
Outcrop Social.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
I want to go. Yeah, I love it.
Well, I'll take you there in September.
Let's do that. And so what do you cook at home?
Well, if we're there and it's Sunday and it's a great sort of traditional Sunday lunch, then we all do our bits. We all love quite spicy food. I love cooking Asian food. I love cooking Indian food in particular. I love grinding spices and preparing things like that. But
It's a lot of process.
It is a lot of work, but that's why it's good to have all your family around you. Yeah. So you can say to someone, look, you do this.
Back to the collaboration.
Yeah.
Exactly. And do you go out to restaurants now?
I don't go out nearly as much. I tend to go out probably more down in the West Country.
Yeah.
And also because as I've sort of moved away from actively being involved in the West End on a daily basis, I'm not there as much in the evening. I still go and see the theatre quite a lot. Mm. So I'll go out to places.
Do you still go after?
Yes.
Do you?
Yeah. I can't bring myself to really have you know, big nursery tea, as we call it, at 5 or 6.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I've got the go-to places like, you know, the Ivy Club and things like that will stay open and, again, are very convivial. But I worked for many, many years with Cameron McIntosh, who is an absolute foodie and a brilliant cook as well. Oh. He was someone else who really inspired me to cook, because we'd shut the office down in the early days. You know, Cats can run itself and Les Mis can run itself. And we'd go off to his place in Scotland and we have the most incredible produce of seafood and things. And we'd all be given a job. And he, as far as he was concerned, it wasn't cooking unless there were at least 20 people around the lunch table. So people come out of the hills. And so that was fun. I learned a lot at his knee, as it were. Yeah. So we'll always go together. But I mean, no, I mean, the days of the high end dining with Adrian and it being fun, I think, are probably behind.
Yeah. And working in restaurants, will you meet people for meetings?
The business lunch is sort of a kind of thing of the past. I mean, in the early days, you know, I'd go off and meet our advertising agents and it would be, you know, and he'd sit down and he'd go, is this a 2-bottle lunch or a 1-bottle lunch? And now it's, I'll have a glass lunch, which is a shame in a way, but probably we get more done. Yeah. I honestly think it was more fun in the 80s and 90s for us than it is now. Because it's much more pressured. The challenges are much more, the margins are much lower. Mm. The good thing is the way we look after people has changed a lot, and you have to do that now, and as you should. And as we know, the actor strike's on at the moment about getting proper recognition, and that's going right through society. So the way we behave has changed. But in terms of that feeling of real excitement, of, you know, I can't tell you what it was like opening Les Mis on Broadway or Phantom on Broadway. And, you know, Saigon, which was a massively controversial production because of the casting. And
I have a letter from you. I don't remember where the correspondence, but it says, I'll read it. I'm going to read you a letter that you wrote me. Ah, darling, I had an emotional evening last night, the first night of Carousel. Adrian was one of my few friends who really enjoyed musicals, and even though we used to warble If I Loved You from it, he never actually had seen the show. They announced a revival just as he got sick, and I made him promise to stay well enough to come to the first night with me. Of course, that didn't happen, so I kept an empty seat next to me. I miss him badly and will definitely know when I'm next seeing you. Much love, Nick. So I was wondering, because I thought you do have one of the most beautiful speaking voices that I know, and I was wondering if you might sing If I Loved You. And here's the lyrics.
I'll have a go.
Should we have a go? Mm-hmm. And I'll sing it with you a little bit.
My great
skin. You know, I grew up on musicals. So I lived in upstate New York. We'd go in the car and we'd drive down the thruway to New York. And we would see the big ships. And we'd see the SS France. And we'd see the United States. Then we would go and have lunch. And then we would go to a musical. We'd go to My Fair Lady, West Side Story. This is, I guess, I was, you know, sort of 12, and so it was early 60s. And then we would go to Sam Goody, a record store. Do you know Sam Goody?
Yes.
And we would buy the record, and then we would drive up back to the country, and we would play the record over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So I know the words to basically every musical of that era, and so I know this song, If I Loved You. So shall we try?
It is one of my favorites. I know the first two lines to more songs.
I'm going to cheat
and read the lyrics. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
If I loved you time and again, I would try to say.
Oh, Ruthie. Oh, I'm gone.
Thank you to Adrian.
Oh, to Adrian Gill. God love you, my
theater,
friend.
To theatre, to Carousel, you, and to love. So the singing can give you comfort, and food can give you comfort. So my very, very last question of talking and listening and singing is to ask you if you have a food that you need, not to eat when you're hungry, but to eat when you need comfort. What would that be, Nick Allen?
If I tell you, you'll be so appalled.
No, I won't, because
it was the most delicious thing I've ever, and I'm feeling really down or depressed or hungry or worn out. And it was actually a concocted recipe by a friend of mine who wrote it in a play. And I read it. I thought, I can't believe he's actually done this, but I'm going to try and put it together. And it is basically toast with peanut butter, very crispy bacon, and cheese melted on top.
I'm not disgusted. I'm interested.
It was...
I think food, because the food that comforts has a story.
Yeah. You know?
Well, the next time you have one, call me. Okay?
Will do. When we go to my son's restaurant, we'll sneak home after.
Oh, yeah, and have a peanut butter sandwich. Thank you very much.
Oh, what a joy.
Great day.
Thank you, Ruthie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.